All right, the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will come to order. Committee Legislative Assistant, call the roll, please.
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Vice Chair Shemansky? Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Champion?
Here.
Representative Cornish? Representative Greenhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Creasel? Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesh? Representative Liebling?
Here.
Representative Mazerol?
Here.
Representative Moline?
Here.
Representative Schumacher? Representative Vogel?
Present.
Representative Wardlow?
Chair notes that a quorum is present. Agenda includes approval of the minutes. Those are in the packet. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Move. Representative Vogel moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Minutes of March 1, 2011 are approved. Members, next week, in addition to continuing our work toward our fiscal deadline later in the month, we will resume hearing bills. And to that end, it's my intention to avoid Friday hearings, if at all possible, but therefore work in the afternoon and late evening if necessary on our normal Tuesday and Thursday hearing days in March. So our hearings will convene at or about our regular time at 8:15 in the morning, but then we will recess if there is still bills on the calendar. We'll recess until later in the day and resume at the call of the chair. Just to tip off, we may work Tuesday and Thursday evenings next week. Now, going further, in your packet in one of the green sleeves is a copy of the presentation that will be made today, as well as a copy of the respondents provided the committee. Additionally, in your folder is a copy of the Supreme Court's order extending the increase in lawyer registration fees. All right, going forward on our budget reviews with the judicial branch, including the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and the District Court, I'd recognize first Chief Justice Lori Gilday.
Good morning.
Morning.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Gilday, the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court and the administrative head of the judicial branch of our state government. I am told that this is the first time, at least in modern memory, that the Chief Justice has testified before legislative committees on the judicial branch budget. Judges are creatures of precedent, and we do not lightly depart from our precedent. I depart from precedent today, however, because of the urgency of the question that we confront in this legislative session. I am here today with Chief Judge Matt Johnson from our Court of Appeals, Chief Judge Ed Lynch from the 1st Judicial District, Chief Judge Jim Swenson from the 4th Judicial District, and our State Court Administrator Sue DeSalle. We are here today not for ourselves. We come to you today on behalf of the little girl needing protection, the small business owner enforcing a contract, the tenant seeking return of her security deposit, and the state seeking to hold an offender accountable in pursuit of the safety and security of all of our communities. The justice system exists not for those of us here today and for those of us working in it every day. The courts exist for the people of Minnesota, the people we serve. All 5 million Minnesotans are our constituents. The Minnesota justice system is at the breaking point. As you have heard in presentations in this room and when I have come to see you in your offices, our judicial system is stressed from top to bottom. Delays and backlogs are commonplace across our state now. One out of four serious felonies takes more than a year to get to trial. For 30% of the abused children taking out of their homes, it takes us more than a year to tell those children where their permanent homes are going to be. In many counties, it is taking as much as a month just to open up a civil or family case. Delays have doubled and in some counties tripled over the past few years. And worse, the Minnesota Court of Appeals has recently dismissed three felony convictions for failure of the state and the district court to meet speedy trial demands, which of course is the ultimate constitutional safety valve for delay in the criminal justice system. The bottom line, Mr. Chair and members, our system is already under great strain in dealing with some of the most important matters in people's lives, their liberty, their property, their families. How did we get to this place? We got here because the judicial branch has been underfunded for a number of years. We have taken base budget cuts in each of the last 3 years. These base budget cuts total almost $19 million. And on top of that, we have had to absorb $2.3 million in unavoidable costs for increased health insurance, which are negotiated by MMB, and statutorily mandated increases in the employer contribution to pensions. We don't control these costs, and we have to cut other things to pay for them. Also last year, the legislature authorized an additional 1% cut, or $646,000 in the Supreme Court base budget for the coming biennium. Because of chronic underfunding and recent base budget cuts, we've lost 270 positions, and we're now operating 10% short-staffed. We've cut positions by implementing a voluntary separation incentive program, voluntary leave without pay, a hiring freeze, and some layoffs. And we've implemented a total pay freeze for all of our employees and judges over the last 2 years. Despite needing more than 20 judges in order for us to be able to handle our work, to help close the budget gap, we have been forced to hold open all judge vacancies for a minimum of 4 months. And we've also taken cuts into the budget for retired judges, which of course exacerbates the judicial shortage. We've taken cuts to drug courts, mandated services, and operating budgets. And we've been forced to close public counters half a day a week in over half of our judicial districts so that the staff that we do have can have some time to catch up on the paper processing, the computer entry, and filing responsibilities for the backlog of cases that keeps stacking up. Mr. Chair and members, as you can see from this brief history, we in the judiciary have for many years been doing more with less. But past budget shortfalls and reductions have cut into the muscle and now the bone. I come before you today to urge the legislature to stop the further dismantling of this core function of our government. I urge you to act to assure a functioning justice system, the system our citizens expect, the system our citizens deserve, and the system our Constitution commands. The question before you, Mr. Chair and members, at bottom is one grounded in constitutional principles. Sometimes when we hear scholars speak about constitutional law, we hear them refer to first principles. Alexander Hamilton wrote in the Federalist Papers that first principles were primary truths upon which all subsequent reasonings must depend. Our Constitution gives us those primary truths, those first principles. Mr. Chair and members of this committee, the first principle that I submit must govern your work is set forth in Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution. In that provision, we the people of Minnesota, promise each other that every person in Minnesota is entitled to justice promptly and without delay. Our Constitution promises that to all of us, to you, to me, to all 5 million Minnesotans, the right to obtain justice promptly and without delay. That is a first principle of our government. I am here today to ask you to ensure that that inspiring and confident command continues to be a reality in Minnesota. The courts are a branch of government. We are not a state agency. We are vital to government's basic function of protecting public safety, ensuring individual rights, and providing a forum for the orderly and civil resolution of disputes. And yet, the judicial branch of your government accounts for less than 2% of the state's general fund. Further cuts to the judicial branch budget can do little to solve the state's financial problem. But I can guarantee you that further cuts to the justice system will have very real and visible consequences in all of our communities. We already have a system so strained that the Court of Appeals has been compelled to reverse criminal convictions in felony cases. And yet, the judicial branch of your government was asked to demonstrate how we could absorb further cuts, those on the order of 15 to 20%. As noted in our response to this request, cuts of this magnitude would require that we lay off almost 700 employees at a 15% cut and 900 employees at a 20% cut. Those employees translate into more than 3 million hours of justice lost in Minnesota. Cuts of such a magnitude would also require that we close up shop in up to 40 of our courthouses. Cuts of this magnitude will also make it impossible for us to handle whole categories of cases during the next biennium and beyond. Now, in order to respond to your request relating to a 15 and 20% reduction to our base budget, the Judicial Council, which is the policymaking body for the branch, reviewed all 51 case types that we handle and ranked them as high, medium, or low priority. In your packet at attachment I is that list. You can see it has some shading on it. All of these cases are important to those that bring them. And all of them are constitutionally mandated by Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution to be handled promptly and without delay. But further cuts to the judiciary will require hard choices to be made and priorities established. Members, a cut of the magnitude at both 15 and 20% level means that we simply will not have the staff to process any of the low priority cases during this biennium. Things like shoplifting, trespass, worthless check, underage drinking, all could not be processed during the biennium. Conciliation court, consumer credit, property-related claims will just sit. The same is true with hundreds of thousands of traffic and ordinance violations. 100% of these cases would languish without staff to process them. These cases are considered low priority only in relation to the other even more serious case types that we handle. To the litigants waiting for a default judgment, tenants trying to get their security deposits back, businesses seeking to deter shoplifting and the passing of worthless checks, and law enforcement trying to enforce traffic, ordinance, and misdemeanor cases in order to maintain order and the rule of law, believe me, these cases are anything but low priority. On top of that, the suggested budget cuts would move us up into the medium priority cases as well. At a 15% cut, we would not have staff to process about 7% of the medium priority cases. A 20% cut would mean that over one-third of the medium priority cases could not be processed in the biennium. Cases in this category include misdemeanor DWIs, all family law cases except domestic abuse, and the rest of our civil cases, including contract, personal injury, guardianship, and conservatorship and the like. The impact here would be increasing delays in a broad range of categories important to businesses, to our citizens, and to the public safety. People waiting for justice and compensation will be forced to wait years before their cases can even begin. These cuts would also put in jeopardy hundreds of millions of dollars that we in the judicial branch bring into other parts of government through our collection of fines and fees. Each year, the judicial branch collects $200 million in fines and fee revenue, primarily through the processing of what we have called low-priority cases. By cutting the judicial branch by 15 to 20%, and without the staff to process these cases, the effect in the next biennium would be the loss of much of the $200 million in revenue that goes to the state general fund and to counties and cities. Counties and cities use this funding, of course, to pay for public safety costs. In your packet at Attachment K, we have provided examples of substantial local revenue generated in Hennepin and Ramsey counties and cities. Hennepin County and its cities could lose up to $18 million in revenue, and Ramsey and its cities could lose as much as $5 million. Without staff to process the hundreds of thousands of traffic tickets, ordinance violations, and misdemeanors, just imagine what will happen on our highways, on the streets of our neighborhoods, and in the shopping centers of our communities. Those accused of crime will be out of custody indefinitely undeterred, increasing risks to public safety. Businesses, families, litigants, and victims all will suffer while waiting for justice. Mr. Chair and members, after years of budget shortfalls and cuts, there are many in the judiciary who feel like we have reached the point where we must simply do less with less. And I have to say that the 15 to 20% cut exercise served to reinforce that view, that we in the judiciary have no choice now but to do less with less. Mr. Chair and members, please do not let it come to that on your watch. The courts are where the people come when the things that are most important to them, their family, their freedom, their property, the things that they treasure the most, they come to the courts when those treasures are threatened. They come to us, and they come looking for justice. Whatever else we do, let us not diminish justice. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I will now ask to be excused because the Minnesota Supreme Court is in session this morning and I must be on the bench. So I will turn the microphone over to my colleagues to continue with our presentation. But before I depart, I want to leave you with this thought from one of our justice system partners, the Bloomington City Attorney, Sandra Johnson. Attorney Johnson submitted a letter as part of our response to the 15 to 20% cut exercise, and it's included in your materials as attachment L. In her letter, Attorney Johnson discusses the impacts that have been suffered in her community by budget cuts to the court system. And she closes with this. She says, "It is much more cost-effective to maintain law and order than to try to recover from its loss. It is much more cost-effective to maintain law and order than to try to recover from its loss." I agree. Mr. Chair and members, let us all resolve to work to maintain law and order. You can help us do that you can help us maintain law and order if you support our budget request. I urge you to do so, to help us preserve justice in Minnesota. To continue with our presentation, I turn to Sue Dosal, our state court administrator, to provide an overview of our FY 10 and 11 budget and our request for the next biennium. Thank you so very much for your service.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Sue Dosal. I'm a state court administrator, and as the chief indicated, my part now is to talk a little bit, to give an overview of our current biennial budget. You can see that the budget is appropriated to our three levels of court, as indicated on this slide, about $561 million, with the largest share going to the trial courts. The trial court budget is composed of a number of elements. For FY 10-11, it was about $480 million. Those components include funding for our 10 judicial district budgets. These include funding for all of our trial court employees and operating costs in each of the 100 locations that we service across the state. Also, the salaries and benefits of our 289 judges, central accounts, which include such items as funding for workers' compensation and unemployment costs, state accounting and payroll system fees, salaries and expenses for our judicial district administrators, and some network costs, and most of the court payment center costs. It also includes a state appropriation for our drug courts, our problem-solving courts. This appropriation funds about 20 of our 38 problem-solving courts. The remaining costs are provided by federal grants from the Office of Traffic Safety, Federal Bureau of Justice Assistance, the Office of Justice Programs, and Department of Human Services. The total budget with federal funding and the state funding for drug courts is about $9 million, and of course we also have contributions, both in-kind and cash contributions, from the counties to the operation of the drug courts. And finally, the final component of the trial court budget is the mandated services, and this includes funding for jurors, for psychological services, interpreters in the form of papyrus costs, and in FY 10 it included the guardian ad litem costs, which, as you know, was transferred to an independent board in this current year. I'm just going to have an overview here from Judge Chief Judge Matt Johnson of the Court of Appeals about the Court of Appeals budget.
Judge Johnson, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Matt Johnson. I'm the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. The Court of Appeals budget in the current biennium is approximately $20.2 million, or approximately $10.1 million per year, as reflected on slide 16. We've divided that budget into four items here. The last item, rent, is approximately $900,000 per year. We pay that to the State Department of Administration. That's been relatively flat. The second item for judges' salary and benefits also has been flat since 2008. The third item, operating expenses, are in the neighborhood of $400,000 per year. These are very ordinary things like office supplies, photocopies, law books, and travel within the state for hearings within greater Minnesota. We're in the process of reducing these expenses. I think before this fiscal year is complete, I think that we'll have reduced that number by approximately one-fourth or one-third. I think that number will be less than $400,000 per year as we go into the next biennium. We're making some serious efforts in that regard. But most significantly, we reduced our subscriptions to law books, which is not something we do lightly, but those are things we rely on. Those are the tools of our trade, but we did that because we felt it was necessary. We want to maximize our people power in the Court of Appeals. And that brings me to the first item, salaries and benefits for staff. At the Court of Appeals, we have only three types of positions in this category. The first one is staff attorneys. We have 7 staff attorneys. 6 of them have been with the court for more than 20 years. They have a high level of expertise and experience that we find very valuable. Second category is law clerks. Typically, talented, energetic, recent law school graduates. We have 2 law clerks per judge. That's been the minimum number that we've had on our court since its existence. Their salaries are far below what the marketplace pays them when they finish their clerkships with us. And third, we have a modest number of administrative assistants. The ratio of administrative assistants to lawyers in our court is lower than any private law firm I know. I want to also emphasize the types of people we do not have at the Court of Appeals. Please understand that our court does not have administrative staff. We do not employ people who are behind a counter to receive filings. For that, we rely upon the clerk of the appellate courts, which is a branch of state court, which is an office within the state court administration budget. We do not employ anybody in finance, HR, or IT, or any other support services. For those types of services, which we need, we rely upon the excellent people in state court administration. We do not employ any professional administrator or office manager or anyone like that. We simply do not have people. We manage ourselves, the judges, the staff attorneys. We have our administrative assistants who pitch in and organize. We're very much self-managed. Every person within our court handles the case files that look like this and is directly involved in the decision-making process. And so if we had to reduce our headcount at the Court of Appeals, thank you, it would necessarily involve lawyers such as law clerks and staff attorneys who are directly involved in assisting judges with judicial, with legal analysis and legal writing. In the past 3 years, our budget has been cut with a number of cuts that have amounted to about 3% of our budget. That has forced us to reduce our number of people. Like the rest of the branch, we have approximately 10% of our positions are left vacant. We've had to reduce our number of law clerks by 15%, and this has had a direct impact on our capacity to decide cases. And if our budget were cut further, we'd have no choice but to further reduce those people. I want to close by just with a little bit of a historical perspective. Our court is 27 years old. It began in 1983 because of a constitutional amendment in 1982. Before that time, the Supreme Court was overloaded with appeals. It simply had far more appeals than a Supreme Court could consider as a Supreme Court should. And so most appellants did not get oral argument before the Supreme Court. They did not get a written opinion with a statement of the reasons for the decision. They got a one-line or one-sentence order. And that was considered intolerable, and so the people amended the Constitution to create the Court of Appeals. And now in every case, an appellant, if the appellant has a lawyer, is entitled to an oral argument before our court, and they receive it, and they also receive a statement of reasons for the decision. And those two fundamental principles we have followed for 27 years. But those two principles are at risk, and in my view, that puts the rule of law at risk as well. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for the opportunity, and I will, of course, will remain available for questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Johnson. Next, Sue.
Mr. Chair, finally, is the Supreme Court budget, which funds 4 primary functions. The Supreme Court operations, which includes, of course, the justices and staff. Second is the State Court Administrator's Office, which provides the central administrative and technology infrastructure services for the entire judicial branch, and also critical information integration services for the criminal justice system as well. Third is our state law library, which serves not just the appellate courts, but all of state government and the general public, and provides critical support for our entire county law library system as well. And last is child support magistrates, who serve as hearing officers in an expedited pro se process to establish and modify child support. This funding is provided for us with a match, $2 of federal funding for every $1 of state funding. So in total, between the state and federal funding, we have about $8 million that are that goes to the child support magistrate process. Mr. Chairman, if you would like, we could stand for questions about our current budget, or if you'd like me, I could just continue through the presentation to talk about our request, our FY 12.
Mr. Sal, I would like to have the entire presentation, and then we will go to questions.
Mr. Chair and members, then the last slide here, close to the last slide, is our FY 12-13 request. For the next biennium, the judicial branch is requesting essentially a hold harmless budget, in which the only new funding that we're asking for is for unavoidable personnel costs. These are the increases for employee health insurance, which is projected by Minnesota Management and Budget, and a small increase, statutorily mandated increase, in the employer contribution to employee pensions. The total for the biennium is $6,750,000 for the entire branch. We have no control over these costs. We just have to pay them. And if we don't get new funding to cover these unavoidable costs, it will just mean that we're going to have to lay off more people in order to pay them. As you've heard today and earlier, the justice system is fraying at the seams, and we are requesting only the funding that will prevent further erosion in our ability to carry out the constitutional mission of the judicial branch. So, Mr. Chairman, now just I'd like to close our formal presentation by asking Chief Judge Jim Swenson and Chief Judge Ed Lynch to come and provide a few remarks from the trial courts.
Your Honors, if you'd identify yourself, then please
sure.
Proceed.
I'm James Swenson, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm the Chief Justice in the Fourth Judicial District, which is Hennepin.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ed Lynch. I'm a judge in Dakota County and currently serve as the Chief Judge of the First Judicial District.
I'm here to add just one more point to the mix. We have been very good stewards of the public's money. I remember in 2003 we started making cuts when we gave money back, and we've been making cuts and changing things the entire time frame. To impress upon my colleagues how serious this is, I invited Tom Stinson to one of our bench meetings to talk about what the next 10 years looks like from a revenue perspective, and we've heard from the state demographer, Tom Gillespie. We understand what the future looks like. We spend a great deal of our time planning on how we can be even better stewards of the taxpayers' money in the future, and we are knee-deep in a number of technological changes that are designed to save money in the future, such as our new civil electronic filing. The end game is to become totally digitized and stop pushing paper around. If we have further cuts, we won't be able to continue with our technological improvements. Right now we do that on the backs of our employees by holding open 35 to 40 positions to manufacture vacancy savings so that 2, 3, 4 years from now we can save a lot of money for state taxpayers.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a challenging session for everyone in this room. It's challenging for you because you have to determine how to allocate the scarce resources that the state provides. It's challenging for everybody else because we have to live with your decisions. I understand and expect that the focus of this session will be on establishing priorities. Those priorities will be based upon the need for and the value of the services provided to the people of Minnesota. I suggest that funding for the court should be one of those priorities. We deserve to be a priority because we provide constitutionally mandated core government services to the people of Minnesota, because we have been responsible stewards for the resources you provided in the past, and because, quite frankly, we've done a good job. Let me talk a little bit about core services. I think when many people think of the courts, they think about parking tickets and criminal prosecution. And while those are important matters that we do process, equally important are three examples I want to give you. The preteen girl who's in the child protection proceeding because of being physically and emotionally abused by her mother wrote a letter to the judge describing the beatings that she endured and said that the beating with the electric cord was the one that hurt the most. She ended her letter in capital letters saying, "Help me, please." The elderly man who lost a leg in an accident was unable to get recommended medical care because the two insurance companies that insured him could not decide which one was the primary responsibility for the bills that he incurred. And the woman who came into court for an order for protection after she found her husband's journal that described detailed plans to kill her and her children. That's why funding for the courts is so important. And as Judge Swenson has indicated, we've been responsible stewards of the resources you've given us. We've embraced technology to try and take advantage of the efficiencies that that would provide us. We've also not ignored the importance of being effective as well. With the justice system partners, we've developed problem-solving courts to address the chemical dependency and mental health issues that so often drive crime and contribute to family dysfunction. We have developed in most districts early intervention in dissolution cases so that these matters can be addressed quickly. With the help of the court, the people can resolve their matters by getting together, having early neutral evaluators help them solve some of the issues that they can't solve themselves. And this approach has been effective in reducing the time involved in these proceedings, minimizing the conflict, and decreasing the cost. And finally, we've done a good job. The funding that you have provided to us has been well spent. Minnesota courts have a national reputation for excellence, innovation, fairness, and impartiality. We are consistently ranked by the National Chamber of Commerce among the top 10 judicial systems in the country for being impartial and timely. And a 2005 public opinion poll found that 80% of the respondents expressed confidence in the courts. Now, I'm not here to talk about the challenges that we face with the funding. I think Chief Justice Gilday did a good job of explaining what the challenges are. And I'm not here to suggest that the sky is falling. You have the judicial branch commitment that we will prioritize the responsibilities we have and do the best that we can to provide services to the people of Minnesota with the resources you provide us. And although the sky is not falling, I am concerned that the roof might collapse. Because in that very process of prioritizing, there will be thousands of cases that we will not be able to process. There will be thousands of people whose constitutional right to timely access to justice will be denied. Now, I am confident that we will be able to keep the murderers off the street. I'm not so sure we'll be able to keep the drunk drivers off the street. I'm concerned that we may have to decide whether it's more important to hold the more than 15,000 people charged each year with domestic assault accountable for their actions, or to process the more than 11,000 requests for orders for protection so that we can avoid the domestic assaults to begin with. We may not be able to do both. And so we're going to have to prioritize, and I would hope that you prioritize as well when you make your funding decisions, because I truly believe that funding for the courts so that the people of Minnesota can have timely access to justice should be just as important as reduced class sizes and shorter commutes. The budget request that we have made is to maintain the status quo so that the abused girl in need of a safe home, the elderly man in need of treatment, and the terrified woman in need of protection will not be turned away. I suggest that the Constitution requires this, the people of Minnesota deserve this, and I urge you to fund this. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Lynch. Ms. DeSalle is at the completion of the presentation. All right, Ms. DeSalle, judges and committee, I want to, we're going to go to questions now, and I'm going to open with a few. I hope my questions run the gamut of what everyone may be thinking, but we will first start with myself and then we'll go to other members. First, I want to just open with a comment, and that's the courts have been a model of innovation in doing more with less, in providing the absolute essential function of government in the administration of justice. It's my firm opinion, both as chairman of this committee, as a state representative, as a simple citizen, and also a participant in the courtroom process over the years, that it's my opinion that if other areas of government would follow your lead, the now recently revised budget shortfall would be far more manageable. Additionally, I want to thank you for your cooperation and assistance in providing to the committee the requested details on your budget. The courts are not a state agency. They are the third branch of government envisioned by the founders of this country to be co-equal and coexistent with the other two branches, and therefore you do have a shared responsibility and burden in confronting the challenges facing us today, and it's my hope, firm hope, that additional cuts will not be necessary. I know you appreciate our responsibility, and we're not going to leave any stone unturned. Now, question number one, you've asked this committee to essentially hold you harmless in providing only the additional money that you need to fund compensation increases outside of your control. Given the shortfall of 20 judges and the backlog of cases that you have and potentially will have, is it your opinion that if the legislature stops cutting and grants your budget, that you can stop the bleeding and bring some stability to the judicial branch?
The answer, from my opinion, is an unqualified yes. The budget cuts in the past have served the purpose of forcing us to reevaluate how we do our business and look at every possible way that we can change the way we do our business. And this has been a decade-long process, and we're lean, but we're limping along. And I think we can continue if we are held harmless from further cuts. I would say, as the chief judge of a very large urban court, that I'm very happy that our Supreme Court agreed to extend the lawyer contribution to the public defenders, because our public defenders are a key component of our justice operations and kind of the molasses that brings the system to a halt if they're underfunded. But with that caveat, the answer is yes.
Judge Lynch.
Mr. Chair and members, I agree with Judge Swenson. I think that we can continue to provide the level of services that we're now providing if there are no cuts. I'd be very concerned, quite frankly, about our ability to continue to provide that level with cuts.
Next question. If this committee were to not provide all of the additional funds requested for the unavoidable health care costs, and this is the question, are there non-essential services that could be reduced further without the loss of staff and diminished courtroom operations?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that we have tried to demonstrate that, you know, this budget is sort of at the breaking point here. It's possible that we could reduce funding for our technology initiatives, for example, and not lay off staff in order to absorb those costs. But by doing that, we are diminishing our investment in the future, which is aimed totally at trying to bring down our labor costs and control our labor costs in the future. So it's a catch-22. Whether it's laying off more staff, which would, of course, reduce our ability to provide services, or take from our limited technology investments that are supposed to provide for the future.
Thank you for that answer. I'm not going to testify, but if I were, I would probably come to the conclusion the answer is no. Next question. Let's move along. If additional funds beyond which what you're requesting were available to the courts, how would you prioritize that spending? In other words, where would that money go? Additional funds.
I don't know that I would have the magic answer to that. I know that one of the things that we're concerned about is the ability to maintain the problem-solving courts that have been such an effective means of addressing some of these underlying issues that have created some turmoil in people's homes and also driving crime rates. I'm sure that would be one thing that we would have to look at, whether we could provide more support for that.
Ms. Bissell.
Mr. Chair and members, as we've said, we've had a loss of about 270 positions. We have some places that are, as we talked about, all of the delays just in the paperwork. I believe that if there was funding, additional funding that would be available, there would be some restoration of those staff positions that we've lost that would offset and help to remedy some of the very serious delays that we have.
I would answer it this way. If we had additional funds and we spent it on employee costs or additional judges, we would be swifter at what we do, and the incredible stress that we've posed on our employees' shoulders would be abated a bit. But that would just continue the status quo. From my perspective, as the chief in a very large urban court, if I had additional dollars, I would spend it on technology. Because once I spend it on technology a few years down the pike, then I would be in the position to lift that stress that we've imposed on our employees. And we would be swifter, not just today, but for decades to come.
Very good. Next question. The current contract for court employees includes a salary freeze. When will you begin negotiations and finalize a new contract, and where will this issue likely when and where will it be revisited?
Mr. Chair, what was the last part of that? I couldn't quite hear.
When will the negotiations to finalize a new contract begin?
Mr. Chair, we would be beginning the contracts for the next biennium this spring, and it would depend on how long those negotiations last, but we certainly would hope before the end of the end of this fiscal year.
I want to clarify one thing. You only negotiate actual salaries, while the MMB is responsible for negotiating your health benefits and what an employee might be required to contribute versus what you have to contribute on pensions. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. To the Legal Professions Board's area, the biennial budget for them for the years 2010 to 11 was $11.3 million. Does this fund ever have ever carry a positive balance from one biennium to the next?
Mr. Chair, yes. These are attorney registration fees that are assessed by the Supreme Court. There are no general fund dollars involved in that. And pursuant to 481.01, these funds do cross the biennium and they do not cancel.
What happens to the surplus at the end of the biennium?
It continues on in the account. At the end of the biennium.
In terms of cash management, are the funds maintained separately or are they combined in one account?
Mr. Chair, there's a single attorney registration fee, but that registration fee is divided among the boards, and there's a separate account for each of those boards.
Do those balances accrue interest, and if so, is the interest included in your budget figures?
Mr. Chair, the only one of the boards that accrues interest is the Client Security Fund Board. This is the board that reviews and pays to clients for their loss due to the dishonesty of lawyers. And that money does accrue interest, and it does go into that fund to continue to allow it to pay those those losses when they do occur. You know, it's sort of like an endowment in that sense. All of the other boards do not accrue interest. We're just in the state treasury like all of the general fund dollars we have.
Okay, next question. I see by the information that we've been provided by the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, that you pay about $6.5 million in rent to the Department of Administration, for which I presume is primarily the use of the Judicial Center. I understand you actually pay rent to use the Supreme Court chamber in the Capitol building, and the district courts pay more than $1 million in rent to the counties for the use of courtrooms. That's the preface. Here's the question. As for the payments to the Department of Administration for the use of state-owned property, are these costs negotiated in any way, or do you simply pay what you're told to pay?
We just pay what we're told to pay.
Are there any controls that you're aware of in state law or rules on what the counties can charge the state for use of county courtrooms, and how are those costs negotiated, if they are?
Mr. Chair and members, by statute, the counties are responsible for providing adequate facilities for the district courts. There are some rent payments that we do pay, but this is normally restricted only to judicial district offices. You know, we have 10 judicial districts. The 87 counties are organized in those 10 judicial districts. So there's usually there is one location within the district where the judicial district office is, and because it is a multi-county function, on occasion we do pay rent for those. Sometimes it's in a county facility and we don't have to pay rent, but there is a little bit of rent that we do pay for that function.
Okay, a couple more areas of questions, and then we'll go to the rest of the committee. The legislature tries to create efficiencies intended to save money and better serve the public interest by creating certain statutory courts with streamlined appeals to the Supreme Court. In your opinion, do these non-judicial branch courts aid in the operation of the judicial branch?
Mr. Chair, are you speaking of the executive branch courts?
Yes.
The tax court, workers' compensation court?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. These are specialized areas of the law and are handled by executive branch courts, and that at some point there needs to be an appeal into the judicial branch. And in some of those, the appeal is to the Court of Appeals. In others, it's directly to the Supreme Court. Otherwise, that would be work that the trial courts would have to do.
Following up on that, are there any areas in which the legislature could improve or expand those specialty courts to help offload some of the judicial branch caseload?
I think there's been some discussion in recent sessions about the possibility of transferring some of the traffic matters to the administrative courts in the executive branch, such things as driving with no insurance, such things as the implied consent process itself. That would be a possibility. Those are the only things I can think of offhand that have been discussed in some other forums.
One final area that I have is we've sometimes discussed in committee that the courts have converted some misdemeanor crimes into payable offenses. Can you talk through that process a little and explain how that works and how you determine what can be a payable and what should remain a misdemeanor?
Well, I'll take a crack at it and then ask my judicial colleagues here to follow up. But by statute and court rule, the judicial council creates what's called the payables list, and it's actually a schedule of bail amounts, which means that it could be payable. Both misdemeanor and petty misdemeanors are on that list. Annually, the judicial council reviews that list. It sends out notices to all interested parties, DNR, anyone that has payable offenses, DNR, Department public safety, county attorneys, public defenders, you know, anyone that might have an interest in this, and ask for comments on things that should be on that payables list or not, whether the fine ought to be increased or decreased. This happens over the summer. We get a list in August. This comments back in August. The Judicial Council reviews that, and then by January 1, submits its conclusion about the payables list. So it's a dynamic list that is reviewed every year. Is there something else that you want to know about the payables? Remain if they're paid. A misdemeanor, if it's paid, it is deemed a petty misdemeanor. If it's not paid, it remains a misdemeanor. So,
can you foresee any potential other misdemeanors that could become payables?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that 2 years ago when we were moving through the legislature with our centralized payables bill, we did request a consideration of language that would say if a misdemeanor is put on the payables list, it would be deemed a petty misdemeanor, which means that if an individual did not pay the misdemeanor, it could be entered as a conviction and sent to collections. That particular aspect of the payables bill did not survive the legislative session, and that's one issue that you might want to consider. And I turn to my colleagues about if there are
Judge
particular Lynn. Misdemeanors that they think should go on the payables
list. Mr. Chair and members, I don't know that I have a list of things that might be added, but I would just comment that this is really a process of prioritization. It's been very, in some respects, controversial. And so when you think about this on relatively minor matters, creating some difficulties in getting consensus, and then we go to the prioritization that we may have to do with additional cuts, and the difficulty that would be for people to accept, I think it demonstrates the reasons that we're here requesting that you don't cut us so that we don't have to go through that process, because it would be very difficult when we have problems with these matters. The types of things that we're looking at with additional cuts would be very controversial.
I have one more question, and then I'm going to go to the rest of the committee. Judge Swenson, I'll pick on you.
All right.
Actually, I'll try not to pick on you because I fear you the most. I've got to drive through your district twice to get here and back home again.
And we monitor your every step.
That's what I thought. Judge, I met with you about a week ago and some others, and I got this sheet that lays out and it's entitled Revenue Collected and Disbursed by Hennepin County District Court for the Municipalities of Hennepin County Fiscal Year 2010. Lists all the cities, I believe, in Hennepin County, for example. And this is a total of $16,646,201.34. Minneapolis, under this column, receives from your court district in that year over $8 million. Would you explain to the committee the $16.6 million revenue, what revenue that is, and what percent of your budget that is, and do you keep any of that money?
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, last year we collected 118% of our budget and sent all that 118% back to our justice partners in the general fund, $32.2 million to the general fund, the rest to justice partners. We don't keep a penny of that, and it's based on the fines and surcharges, and yes, we send that back to each one of the municipalities. very critical money. My wife serves on the city council in my community, Edina, and we sent $1,160,000 to that community last year, and that is basically funds their entire planning department and throw in three or four firefighters or police officers. It's very critical money to those communities, and they would be in a sorry state if we did not send that. I think Mark Thompson, my district court administrator, looked at all that money across the Hennepin County spectrum and figured out that we roughly fund around 200 police officers in I might even be low on that, but it's a large number of the public safety police officers that are basically funded through that money.
So, Judge, in fines and surcharges that you collected in Hennepin County last year, $16.6 million. And you can use yes or no, because I'm going to ask a series of questions. $16.6 million collected in fines and surcharges. Did your district court keep any of that money?
Not a penny.
And was it all turned over to the cities listed on this chart in Hennepin County?
All that $16 million plus? Yes.
And the income that you received off the fines and surcharges exceeded by 18% what you received from the state to run your operation.
Correct.
Okay. Paige, I'd like you to make copies of this for the committee. And with that, we're going to go to questions from other members of the committee. I'm going to start with Representative Hillstrom, and then we've got Anderson, Johnson, Liebling, and Lesh. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have this Minnesota Judicial Branch case type priorities. Do you have the numbers of cases over time so that we can see if these case numbers have been increasing or decreasing or what areas we have seen growth? And then do you have an idea of what we might see in case numbers going forward?
Ms. DeSalle.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, are you asking for that now or you'd like that information?
I would like it if you have it available.
We can provide that, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was some discussion about potentially passing something off to administrative courts, and both implied consent was discussed and potentially some traffic. Isn't there an issue with enhanceability, for example, if the implied consent was moved to the an administrative side, we would not be able to use that as we currently can for felony DWI?
Judge Lynch.
Well, there may be, but I know that there was some talk about the administrative process taking over that to address the driver's license issues that are inherent in the implied consent. And you're right, an implied consent revocation can also be used as a factor in enhancing a future drinking driving offense. I don't know whether it would be the prerogative of the legislature to make a determination whether the administrative process would have the same type of enhanceability. I think that would be problematic.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also with discussion of the payables list, there was some discussion about bringing some of the DNR. I believe the public defenders brought forward an idea of bringing the DNR over some of those tickets over to the payables list. What happens to restitution when something goes from being a misdemeanor to then being on the payables list? For example, it's $500 if you illegally shoot a deer for restitution for the DNR. So if you make it a petty payable, what happens to the restitution that we have in statute?
Judge Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, first of all, I think restitution could always be handled in the civil setting, whether it's conciliation court or other process. I'm not recommending that, but that is one possibility. And restitution is an important aspect in talking about the collections in Dakota County, for instance. In addition to the fines and fees that were collected, the court collected over $3 million in restitution for crime victims. So that is an important process of the courts. Quite frankly, in my district, we haven't seen a lot of the DNR offenses that include restitution, so I really don't know how big of a factor that is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So who would have those numbers about restitution ordered in those kinds of offenses? Would I have to get that from the DNR, or would you have that? Or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I'm not sure, but we will get back to you on that.
That would be great.
I'll give you an answer for this.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Nope.
All right. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I've on your presentation, you went through on page 16, the Court of Appeals, you know, the judge's number and then the staff number. And you mentioned Court of Appeals, you have 7 staff attorneys. So basically for each of the different areas, the Supreme Court judges and then the Court of Appeals and then the District Court judges, how many staff people, like, are they allocated per judge at some of these districts? Like, I think the District Court, you maybe just get 1 staff or something. But can you tell me if what kind of support staff you have for each of the different areas, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and then the District Court?
If I understand by support staff, I believe you're referring to, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I believe you're referring to non-attorney staff. Is that my understanding?
Well, does each, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Anderson.
Does each judge get allocated certain people that are helping them, or is it like in your in the Court of Appeals, you said there's 7 staff attorneys, so that's for all the Court of Appeals people?
Correct.
And then after that, what support staff does each Court of Appeals judge get, and what does the Supreme Court get?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, each Court of Appeals judge has 2 law clerks at present and 1/2 of an administrative assistant. The 7 staff attorneys are in what we call central staff. They serve the court as a whole. They're not assigned to any judge, and those 7 staff attorneys make very good use of 2 administrative assistants.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chairman, for the Supreme Court judges?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, at the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice has 2 law clerks. The other 6 justices have 1.33 law clerks. And they have 5 judicial assistants that are shared among the 7.
Any further, Representative Anderson?
And then, Mr. Chairman, for the District Court, what do they get?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and that varies by district. In order to help save money, the judges have compromised their staff. And, for example, in my district, we are making use of what's called the Court Record Project, where we have one court reporter who looks at monitors in multiple courtrooms and monitors those. I have not approved any hiring freeze exceptions for any of my new judges to hire new law clerks. So I have many judges, new court reporters. I have many judges that don't have court reporters. I have some that do. I have some that are in the central monitoring room, but our court reporter complement is down significantly. That's how we've shared in the pain, so to speak, of the budget cuts. And we have law clerk sharing arrangements. It's different for each court because the demands for writing differs. So within my district, it's different when you go from family court to criminal court. And then when you go outstate Minnesota, the districts change. I know, I believe it's down in the 3rd, they have a law clerk pooling arrangement where they have roughly 70 or 65 to 70% of their law clerk complement, and then they pool it. I'm not intimately familiar with each district, but we talk at the Judicial Council on a regular basis how we're trying to save money, and I know that each district goes about it in a different way. But the districts have their judges staffed as they were before we started going down this path about a decade ago.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Anderson.
Have some law clerks, have you been cutting positions of law clerks, and so not every judge has their own law clerk then?
Judge Swenson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's true in some districts. In one of the things we're doing in Hennepin, for example, just show you how different it is because we're so large, we've imposed a 30-day hiatus on hiring a law clerk if a judge is going to be allowed to hire a law clerk. And there's so many that we've manufactured 3+ positions by adding all those 30 days. So, and we're trying to be very creative in the way we save money, and that's, you know, that's the way we're doing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Johnson, Liebling, Lesh, Cornish. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I look at the hold harmless budget request here, I'm not convinced it, in fact, does hold harmless the administration of justice, and it, in fact, appears to me it still diminishes courts and weakens communities, as shown up on this slide there. When I look at your measures of effectiveness, for example, for the different courts, it seems like you're not meeting the standards in these very important areas of backlog and delays and so forth. I guess my question to you is, why don't you ask for what you really need and make the real request for what's going to make this third part of government, this justice system, work as effectively as it should for the public? I mean, otherwise we're just going to see again in 2 years with another request with the same slideshow, with the same lack of funding. Why don't you just make a straight-up request for what it is you really need to make the justice system work the way it should work for the public?
Ms. DeSalle.
Chair, and Representative Johnson, this was a very difficult discussion that the judicial branch had and that the judicial council decided. There are many people that feel, as you do, that we should ask for everything that the judicial branch needs to do its work and to do it promptly and without delay. Others felt that we needed to recognize the historic budget challenges that the state of Minnesota faces and ask for only that would prevent further erosion to where we are right now, with the hope I think all of us as citizens have, that the economy is going to turn around and in you know a future biennium or two that we then can come forward and talk about the restoration of some of these cuts that we have taken over the years. It's a difficult decision, but that's the one that the Judicial Council made.
Representative Johnson.
Well, just that point, I guess this has been an ongoing problem. This isn't something that's a total surprise, although the economy has certainly soured over the last couple of years. So it seems like it's something, if you truly believe in, you need to be bold about in requesting. And that would give us a little more greater sense of how strongly and how important it is to the ongoing democracy of this state. It is a comment on my part.
Judge Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, this has been a difficult discussion in the Judicial Council, and I think the consensus was that as an equal branch of government with the legislature and the executive branch, that the judicial branch had a responsibility to recognize this difficulty that you're facing and had to share in that difficulty. Now, we could provide you with the numbers that we think would be appropriate to fund us at a level that we think would be appropriate and that would help us maintain the level of services that the people of the state deserve. But we believe that it was unrealistic that it would be funded, and we thought that we would come in with a budget that we could support in these difficult economic times.
Representative Johnson, Chair, thanks for your questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I think Representative Johnson's point is very well taken, first of all. And just first a comment, and then I do have a question. But, you know, it occurs to me that, of course, I very much support the way you always do frame your budget request, which is we are a branch of government, not a state agency. And I just would like to point out that the executive branch is also a branch of government. And yet we're constantly going after the executive branch agencies. And we should. I mean, we do have to, we have the responsibility initially, at least, of the budget. There is a level of respect there that we need to maintain across the other two branches as well. So that's my comment. But there was a comment made earlier about this so-called hold harmless budget. that if there were no cuts, that you could maintain the same level of service. I think that the two chief judges both kind of chimed in on that. And my question to you then is, you know, what about if the legislature continues to increase penalties and continues to create new crimes, as we are seeing this session, that in spite of this situation that we're all very cognizant of, I hope we all are, that we are seeing bills to increase penalties and to create new crimes and to drop the level of at which a child can be considered an adult and all these kinds of things. You know, what happens in that scenario, even if we were to hold your budget harmless?
Judge Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, one of the things, as you know, is that fiscal notes are requested from the judicial branch for these types of bills. And in that, we try and describe the economic impact it would have on the judicial branch, how many more judges it would take to process those cases, how many more staff it would take to make sure that those cases were processed in a timely manner. And we're hoping that those fiscal notes will guide the legislature when it's making those determinations, that perhaps in addition to whatever our hold harmless budget request is, they would recognize that these additional responsibilities would add additional cost to the judicial branch.
Anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just if I could, kind of a little bit of a different topic, but we spent some time talking about the fines and surcharges that are collected at the district court level and where those go. And I'm just, for the benefit of the new members, and maybe they know this, but I think it's important to emphasize anyway, if you could explain why the courts don't keep that money. Why can't the courts essentially provide part of their own budget with those fines and fees, or those surcharges and fines that you are collecting?
Sue DeSalle.
Chair and Representative Liebling, I think the reason is that we don't want an appearance that our decisions are money budget driven. You may think back in history to Justice of the Peace, cash register justice and the like. That's the reason that we do not want to be in the business of funding ourselves through the fines and fees that we assess.
Thank you. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One dovetails off of Representative Liebling's question about the changing, this body's changing of crimes. Am I to understand, are all three of your honors up there on the Judicial Council?
Yes.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, then to the testifiers, I know based on the testimony earlier that you stated somewhat how items are placed on a payables list. But based off of Representative Liebling's question about changing laws around here, I'm wondering if maybe it can save us some time because, for example, we passed House File 57, Representative Creasel's bill passed off the House floor, and from all the indications, it may be cannon fodder for what the Judicial Council can consider to turn into a payable from being a criminal action to the courts considering non-criminal or a payable. Could any of you testify on that bill and its criteria for matching what would be on your payables list?
Judge Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, I hate to be in this position to say that I'm not familiar with that bill, but I am not. If you get a little bit more detail, I might be able to address the question.
Well, maybe better than that, rather than get into the details of the bill, because I know we're limited on time. But I'm just saying it would be really handy to have some better criteria, because if we have bills that come through this body that some members think are going to be criminal, and then later on by a broad policy decision they don't, we could be saving some time at the committee. So that was my question. Maybe I can get some answers from you offline about that. My second question relates to Representative Johnson's question, Mr. Chair, and that is regarding the hold harmless budget. It's my understanding that people are being let out of prison now, because of delays. So are we really holding harmless? And if you receive the requests that you're getting at the level, which is a very modest request, will that not happen anymore? And if so, why not, if you're just being held harmless?
Judge Swenson.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a new scenario for us, and it's causing us to rethink ways in which we do business. For example, in Hennepin, we used to have the equivalent of 1.5 judges in each one of our suburbs. That's 3 suburbs on a weekly basis. We just instituted a new pilot program that reduces the judge complement in the suburbs to 1 per week. Hence, we've saved the equivalent of 1.5 judges where we can put more resources into our felonies. So we're looking at it from that perspective. The problem is that each day when public defenders show up in our courts, they're scheduled to be in 3 or 4 places at the same time. If I add more judges to the felony, then public defenders are going to be in 5 or 6 places at the same time. And one of those 3 cases that you're talking about happened in our court. And we had 2 continuances that were imposed by the court for the court's own purposes, but that followed on the heels of about a year when the continuances were related to the public defenders and or the prosecutors being unable to proceed ahead. So to some extent we don't control that, but we're trying to, in Hennepin, have these new block systems where we're working with our public defenders and prosecutors to try to reduce the number of public defenders that appear in front of a certain group of judges so that we can better manage that. So we're becoming better at case management, and I think that we can do that within our hold harmless budget.
Very good. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, Your Honors, if anybody could answer this, and then I might ask the chair to put our fiscal and our research person on this too, but the boondoggle of implied consent in Minnesota, is it true that other states, they have an agreement that when you get your license, you just basically agree to take a test, unlike Minnesota, and that Minnesota's, it seems like a really complicated system we got, and if you could furnish us with the number of cases that the judges, public defenders, and prosecutors, some type of hours that they put into implied consent hearings. I know law enforcement officers are driven crazy by going to all these things. It's an expense for law enforcement, for public defenders, county attorneys, judges. Just, and is there any studies that you know of that compare us with other states that have different systems where it's automatic, where you take the test, where you don't get all these levels of appeal in between?
Judge Lynn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, the implied consent process, the last time I looked, I think there was about 4,000 that were filed in Minnesota last year. And these are prosecuted by the Attorney General's office, so it's not by the local prosecutors. Typically, the public defender is not involved in those because these are considered civil actions, and so if people are bringing these challenges to the revocation, they would either be represented by private attorneys or else representing themselves. The time, we can probably determine the court time because we have the records as to how much time it takes in court to process these files. We might not be able to tell you what the time that the Attorney General uses to process those cases. I think that even in Minnesota law, it's implied that you will take the test. But the legislature has set up this process that they can challenge the revocation, and that's why they come to court to vindicate that right, that statutory right to challenge that revocation process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
If you could furnish it just with your costs, then, when I'm looking back at it, I think now on the public defenders and such, you're right. but on the court's cost and somehow number of cases or hours, that would be great. And if our researcher could check us out with other states and how they handle implied consent, and if we didn't have it, we had it like a minimal amount, like some states, how much money we'd save. That'd be great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, very good. Representative Lesh.
Representative Cornish, one of the things that I know prosecutors attempt to try to do to alleviate this is getting defendants in the interest of the bargain, in a plea bargain, to waive that implied consent. And depending on how often new prosecutors are trained in on that, some of them are more diligent about that, thereby alleviating the numbers. But really, for the defendant or the defense attorney, it comes down to whether or not it's even worth it. Because if you can beat the implied consent, that's a completely different deal.
Senator Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at Attachment F, Ms. Dozel, it talks about the new hires and that there's been 57 new hires since December 1st, it says through February 18th. Just, are those filling positions that were vacant from before? Are those recent people who have left, or how are we filling them?
Ms. DeSalle.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, yes, these are filling positions. We have vacant positions. We have essentially a hiring freeze, and so we have to look at each of these. But as you can see, a lot of these are law clerks. There's some judges in there, right. Court reporters, positions that are essential to the adjudicative process.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Thank you. Anything further? All right. Do you have, there are no other questions that I can see. Do you have any closing remarks?
Well, Mr. Chair, just on behalf of the Chief Justice and the Judicial Council, we want to thank all of you for your service and for your attention to these very important concerns of the justice system. It is a justice system that is fraying at the seams, and we hope very much that we can help you to educate and provide this kind of information to the legislature so that they understand the consequences of what further cuts might be. So I think with that, Mr. Chair, thank you so much for having us here today, and we stand available for any questions that you might have in the coming days.
Thank you, Ms. DeSalle, Judge Johnson, Judge Swenson, Judge Lynch. Thank you for your testimony, and I'll get back to your benches and see to it that our constituents have justice. We will meet again.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about committee process when you get a second.
Yes, sir. Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Just briefly, do you have a target date for when the budget bill will be leaving this committee at this point, or any thoughts on that?
Well, we've got a deadline of March 25, so that's the drop-dead date.
We don't have any date, Mr. Chair, other than that right now.
I think we need as much time as we're going to take up to that point. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Any other questions? All right. If there's no other business, until our next meeting, this committee is adjourned.